Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today are semantic threat researchers Bridget O'Gorman and Candid West. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about how threat researchers have created a proof of concept exploit for the Bluekeep bug, how Google can scan Gmail users' emails to collect information on their purchases, an international law enforcement operation against the Gosnim cybercrime network, how some ransomware recovery services have been simply paying off attackers, and how Intel CPUs have been impacted by a new MDS side channel attack. But first, a government worker in Australia will this week appear in court charged with using his employer's computer systems to mine cryptocurrencies. The 33-year-old man was arrested last year after the Australian Federal Police searched his home and seized his laptop, his phone, his employee ID cards, and a number of data files. Details of the case are still relatively sketchy, but the police claim that he made approximately 9,000 Australian dollars, which is around 6,200 US dollars, from his activities. And if that's the case, he must have been mining for quite some time or using a serious amount of his employer's infrastructure. So you might be thinking that mining cryptocurrencies at work may be a breach of your contract or your employee code of conduct, but is it actually a crime? Well, according to the Australian police, in this case at least, it is. The man is charged with two offences: unauthorised modification of data to cause impairment and unauthorised modification of restricted data. And if convicted, he faces a maximum penalty of 10 years imprisonment. It's an interesting case and will no doubt be watched closely in Australia and further afield, but this isn't the first time someone has been charged with using their employer's computers to mine cryptocurrencies. For example, last year, several engineers at one of Russia's top nuclear research facilities were arrested after they reportedly attempted to use its powerful supercomputers to mine Bitcoin. The employees worked at the facility in the city of Sarov, which is run by the Russian nuclear agency Rosatom, and is responsible for the development of the country's nuclear weapons. Describing them as bungling miners, a spokeswoman said that they were detained for an attempt to use their work computing facilities for personal ends, including for so-called mining. She added that their activities were stopped in time so that no coins were actually mined at the facility. So let's move on to our next item, because last week Microsoft patched a critical vulnerability in RDP, and any Windows user who hasn't updated their operating system yet should definitely do so as exploits are starting to appear.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in the May patch Tuesday from Microsoft, they informed about the critical remote code execution vulnerability in RDP, so the remote desktop protocol. And the vulnerability with the number CVE-2019-0708 has now actually been dubbed Bluekeep and appears kind of all over Twitter and other social media networks. This vulnerability could allow an unauthenticated remote attacker to connect to an exposed Windows server via the RDP and then execute arbitrary code on the remote server, and that without the need of any user interaction. So such a vulnerability is, of course, a primary candidate for a self-propagating worm. And as we all remember, the Eternal Blue SMB vulnerability that was then later misused by WannaCry and led to lots and lots of infections, we hopefully all identify that this is a serious vulnerability that definitely needs to be patched as soon as possible, or as in now, if you haven't done it so. So far, we have not seen any indication that this vulnerability is actually exploited in the wild, but this could, of course, change at any minute. At first, there were only fake exploits code floating around the internet. One redirected you to the classic Rickroll video, "They never gonna let you down," and others would open up a message box on your system once you execute it.
Okay, you've explained very well how serious this is. And all of this shows that you should never just blindly run scripts that you found on the internet on production systems if you don't understand what they do.
That is definitely true. But end of last week, the situation changed a little bit as multiple researchers actually confirmed that they reverse engineered the patch and created their own working proof of concept code. So it is probably just a matter of time till now some real and actually working exploit code leak to the public internet. As the bad guys, they probably have for sure reverse engineered the patch themselves. According to Microsoft, the vulnerability affects Windows 7, Windows Server 2008, Server 2003, and also the old XP systems. So if you have RDP servers directly exposed to the internet, then it might also be a good idea to re-elevate if you really need them to be reachable from everywhere. Maybe consider changing the default port to something else, or put them behind an access broker with strong authentication. You can also enable the network level authentication, NLA, which is a feature for RDP, which mitigates this specific vulnerability. Although having said that, there are of course other threats out there. For example, we still see lots of targeted ransomware groups trying to brute force passwords on RDP servers to get a foothold on a company. And in regards to the Bluekeep vulnerability, Symantec has released IPS signatures to protect our customers. And of course, there are also public YARA rules available that can help to detect some of the exploit attempts.
Okay, so only a matter of time, I think, before we're going to see cyber criminals develop an exploit and see it used in the wild. Now, let's move on to the topic of privacy, because as we outlined in our GDPR anniversary podcast that went out last week, privacy is a major area of concern for people at the moment. And there was some more news this week that might annoy some people, but maybe not surprise them.
Yeah, I certainly wasn't too surprised by this story, though perhaps that's just a bad sign about kind of what my expectations are at this stage about privacy online. So a Reddit user post last week pointed out that they had found that their Google account's purchases page contained information about all of the purchases they had made online, including purchases from non-Google companies such as Amazon or ASOS, for example. And this, they said, was despite the fact that they did not use Google Pay. So there was no way that Google could have gotten the information through that avenue. So following that post, Bleeping Computer looked into this a bit more, and the reporter Bleeping Computer found that on their own Google purchases page also, it contained similar information about purchases from non-Google companies. And I checked my own Google purchases page too just before I came in to do this podcast, and I did indeed find information there about purchases I'd made on websites like Amazon and ASOS and other companies online as well. Now, Google did admit what seemed to be really the only logical explanation for this, which is that it was scanning emails in people's inboxes for purchase receipts and then extracting that information to display it on the purchases page. Now, when contacted about this activity by Bleeping Computer, Google did confirm that the information was coming from Gmail messages, but it said that the information was collected in order to make it easier for users to find information and keep track of their purchases. And it insisted that it didn't use this data to, you know, serve users' ads or to, you know, use it in those kind of decisions. However, Google didn't give a definitive answer when it was asked then if the data was being used for anything else by the company itself. And I suppose while there is an argument there that, you know, this may indeed make life easier for some people and allow them to find their purchases quickly if they're looking for them, there does seem to be no way to opt out of this. There's no way to opt out of Google scanning your emails for this kind of information and displaying your data in this way. And also deleting your purchases from this record is not very straightforward. There's no way to kind of mass delete them. You have to individually click into each purchase record separately, click remove, and then delete the email that the purchase is linked to. So that's quite annoying for anyone who may want to scrub this information from this page. Now, Google hasn't provided any further updates to Bleeping Computer since they published their original article, from what I can see. So we don't know if it's likely that they will make it any easier for people to delete these purchase records or to opt out of this service altogether. However, I suppose it is good that people are now, you know, aware of this, aware that it's happening. And then I guess it gives them the option if they want to kind of alter their use of these services, if they're not happy that their information is being used in this way.
Yeah, I checked myself actually before we recorded, and I found purchases going back about 6 years, including a lot of things I don't remember buying. But the one thing that strikes me about this story is that they say it's for the users themselves to find information, but I don't think this feature, I've ever seen it publicized at all. This is the first I've been aware of it, you know, so it's a bit odd. Now, next up, a joint international operation led by the FBI and Europol dismantled the Gosnim malware network this week. And Candid, you have some more information on this, don't you?
Yes. So last week, the joint operation conducted by various law enforcement and police agencies resulted in multiple house searches and then also arrests and charge of about 10 people with conspiracy to commit computer fraud, wire fraud, bank fraud, and also conspiracy to commit money laundering. So all individuals were related to the Gosnim network. And Gosnim is a malware probably primarily known for attacking and defrauding online banking customers. But the group also operated bulletproof hosting, spamming services, and cash out services. So the Gosnim malware infected around a few 10,000 computers, mainly in the US and Europe, over the last few years. The FBI and Europol estimate that the group is responsible for losses of about $100 million. And now, after a long investigation, the cooperation between the United States, Georgia, Ukraine, Moldavia, Germany, Bulgaria, and Europol and Eurojust finally were able to dismantle the cybercriminal group. And of course, we know that Gosnim was not the only active group and that probably others will happily come in and fill the void. It is nevertheless definitely a good news, and it's very nice to see that the international collaboration between those various law enforcements actually keeps growing even further every year. And we as Symantec help as well and assist with technical knowledge about the threats out there, so that in the end, we all together can hopefully make the internet a safer place.
Okay, good news indeed. Now, we discussed targeted ransomware on our last News Roundup podcast and how it's become an increasing problem for businesses. And then there was a story this week that some of the victims of ransomware might be very interested in.
Yeah, ProPublica published quite a lengthy investigation at the end of last week, alleging that two US-based self-described data recovery firms that purport to offer ethical solutions to ransomware attacks, in fact, often just pay off the ransomware criminals. And seemingly this is unbeknownst to their customers, who presumably had employed the services of these firms in an effort to ensure that their money doesn't actually end up in the hands of cyber criminals. And as well as customers, handing over the equivalent amount of the ransom, in most of these cases as well, they're also charged quite a hefty additional fee by the company on top of that. So it ends up costing them quite a lot of money. And so really, it seems that these customers perhaps would have been better off just paying off the cyber criminals themselves, because all that's happened now is it seems the cyber criminals got the money anyway, and then the company itself was in fact just charged additional fees. So the two companies that were discussed in this ProPublica report were a New York firm called Proven Data Recovery and a Florida-based firm called Monster Cloud. Now, ProPublica found evidence that Proven Data Recovery had frequently paid off the SamSam ransomware gang to obtain decryption keys and to recover customers' files, and then obviously using part of the fees that they charge customers to pay that ransom. And a former employee told ProPublica that the company regularly made these payments to the SamSam gang, and ProPublica said that the analysis of the blockchain that they carried out themselves confirmed that funds had been transferred from a wallet that was owned by Proven Data Recovery to one specified by the SamSam attackers. Now, these funds were then laundered through multiple different wallets before then ending up at a wallet that was linked to SamSam that is now subject to sanctions that have been imposed by the US Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control, meaning that anyone who is paying money to these accounts now is breaking US law. Now, the chief executive of Proven Data Recovery did admit that paying attackers is a standard procedure of the company, though it's not clear if that is something that customers are aware of. He also said that the company had stopped paying SamSam ransoms once the sanctions were imposed, which followed the arrest of two individuals believed to be linked to SamSam late last year. And when it comes to the other company, Florida-based company MonsterCloud, which also markets itself as a data recovery service, it also allegedly frequently simply pays ransom demands, and apparently often without informing either its customers or law enforcement, according to this investigation. And its chief executive said that the company's data recovery solutions varied, but she declined to say anything further and simply stated that its methods were a trade secret. Now, I mean, companies do exist that facilitate companies who become victims of ransomware, who want to pay the ransom, as of course often victims may not understand how to do that, you know, understand Bitcoin or how you would go about paying a ransom. And that is a perfectly legal service to offer. While we don't recommend paying ransoms to cyber criminals, and nor does the FBI, you know, there's nothing in the law that prevents victims from doing this. But I suppose the issues raised in this investigation are that it appears that users of these company services may not have known that cyber criminals are receiving this money, that they were attempting to recover their files without paying the ransom, but were in fact, you know, just being seemingly misled and charged very high fees on top of just paying the ransom anyway. So I suppose the best way to protect yourself, but both from ransomware and from potentially being tricked like this, is to reduce your risk of becoming infected with ransomware in the first place by ensuring that, you know, all your systems are well protected by with security software, and that all your staff are also, you know, well versed in security best practices, such as not opening unsolicited emails or downloading malicious attachments, which, despite sounding, you know, pretty basic, is still how we often see ransomware finding its way into companies.
Yeah, I read that ProPublica piece myself. It's really detailed, really great bit of research. Now, finally, some more CPU side channel attacks emerged in recent days. And Candid, you've been reading up on this one.
Yeah, so do you remember kind of over a year ago at the beginning of 2018 when the Meltdown and Spectre chip vulnerability got disclosed? Well, we and a few other researchers kind of all agreed that this would definitely draw some interest from researchers and that there will be more to follow. And there have already been over a dozen of new low-level vulnerabilities last year. You might remember Foreshadow. And now, as you mentioned, last week, a new class was discovered and given the name Microarchitectural Data Sampling, or short MDS. And these vulnerabilities, so there are actually four of them at the moment, are also kind of similar speculative execution side channel attacks, similar to Meltdown and Spectre. And of course, they all have their own funny names as well, as you would expect. So one is called Zombie Load, you got Fallout, you got Riddle, or you got Rogue In-Flight Data Load. So oversimplified, these flaws let an attacker read out data from the physical system that they should not have access to, which definitely is bad, right? More technically, the researchers were able to misuse the speculative execution performed by Intel chips. And this feature allows actually a processor to kind of guess ahead of time what operations and data will be asked to execute, what it will be asked to execute next. And then in order to speed up the chip's performance, it can already preload the data. And if it's not used or if it guessed wrong, just discard the data. And this is obviously done before any permissions are checked and therefore can also be used to leak data. And this can result in revealing any data that is processed by the chip. So it could be passwords, access keys, or some other sensitive information that you might have somehow executed or processed on your physical system. And all the attacker needs to do is run its malicious code on a vulnerable Intel CPU. And one example given by the researcher was a low-privileged user running the exploit to reveal the root password hash on a Linux computer. So privilege escalation. But of course, especially in shared cloud environments, these flaws can be very dangerous, as you might not be able to control what the other people run on their own virtual machine, so outside of yours, even though it's on the same physical box, which means it's also using the same physical chips. The flaws affect kind of almost every Intel chip dating back to as far as 2008. So luckily, there are patches available for most software and hardware configurations by now, but people should actually install the Intel CPU microcode updates and also the updates for the operating systems, regardless of it being Windows, Linux, or OS X or whatever. So all the major cloud providers, such as Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, said that they have already patched their infrastructures, but you might want to double check whatever cloud you use that they have patched indeed. And we have at the moment, luckily, no indication of exploitations in the wild, but we will keep an eye open for it. And of course, we will also watch for probably the next chip vulnerability to come, as I have the feeling that this was not the end of this story yet.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Okay, that's all about we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week, where we'll be talking about what's new in the world of cybersecurity. Until then, thank you and goodbye.